Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Have you ever been picked on, underestimated, or even discriminated against because of the way you talk? Today on Inside Appalachia, we're talking about language, and we'll hear about two projects that are hoping to raise awareness about the Appalachian dialect and our distinct voice. We'll start with a segment that provides a unique opportunity to hear a conversation with a native Appalachian chatting with two people who are considered transplants, meaning they weren't born here, but they moved here. It's a conversation on the West Virginia Public Broadcasting podcast called The Front Porch. In it, executive director and host Scott Finn talks about accents with his guests. Like Scott, conservative columnist Laurie Lynn is a transplant to Appalachia. The two of them talk with Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee and a native of West Virginia. In this conversation, Rick shares a few tips with Laurie and Scott on how to speak Appalachian. And just a small warning, Rick also shares some of his favorite Appalachian cusses.
Rick, as the person that has, of the three of us, the stereotypical Appalachian accent, how's it played out in your life? Do you think it's changed how people see you?
You know, it's the kind of thing you don't notice, you know, growing up here. You notice it when you travel, or you notice it when you're going around people who are different or when they come here. And it's, in some ways, it's been a source of great fun and amusement. Like when my wife and I first met each other in New England, we'd be working with groups, and she'd say, if anyone needs a translation, I speak hillbilly, you know, and you know, sometimes you can kind of play with it and have fun with it, but I didn't realize it until probably I was in junior high and started talking to Huntington girls, and Huntington, as you guys know, is this Babylon, you know, and I was an innocent boy from the sticks, and so some of my accents, some of my expressions, they just thought was hilarious.
So when they say it's hilarious, were they making fun of it? I mean, they weren't laughing with you, were they?
Probably not, no. I mean, at a certain point, I would have been right there with them, but not right then. I remember one time I said, I reckon, and someone said, what? You know, I reckon. And I had to explain to him what it meant, and then she said, I'd reckon. I said, no, you don't say it like that.
Some of the distinctive features that are still at play, the difference between the thing that you write with and the thing that you prick your finger.
They're both pens, Scott. Just deal with it. And people have called me out on that one quite a bit.
It's not pen and pin?
No.
What?
Pen. I can't even say that without cringing.
inserting an R, like I'm going to go wash my hands. Apparently, if you had lived in George Washington's time, it would have been George Washington.
One thing distinct from the Deep South, you know, Rick Bragg said at least we pronounce our R, say what you want about the word. We don't say mother, we say mother. You know, we at least have the letter R in our vocabulary.
Right, you insert it in places like Hollow,
yeah, where it
actually isn't.
Yeah, I like the letter R. So, yeah. Cussing is like, in my family and many others, is like Appalachian punctuation. You know, my father had all these great metaphors. Something that looks really bad, my dad would say, that looks like a dog's ass sewed up with a log chain. And try to get that image out of your mind for a while.
wait, again, say it slower.
Okay, that looks like a dog's ass sewed up with a log chain. And don't try that at home, please. I love dogs. So.
What's a log chain?
Yeah, what is a log chain?
Big chain you use when you're logging to drag the logs around. So, just a little contrasting images there for your listening pleasure.
Even if you're not, I think, doing it in a jokey way, I think almost everyone can identify with speaking a different way with your parents, with your kids, at home when you're comfortable, than you do in a professional environment or on West Virginia Public Radio. And I mean, they call it code switching, right?
Exactly.
I think everybody does that to one extent or another. But one question is, should people make an effort to learn to talk in a more, you know, neutral, mainstream way? You don't want to use that word if you're interviewing for a job.
And code switching is something linguists talk about a lot. And it's something a lot of people do. I think it's one way to validate. And when I was teaching GED classes, you know, we're talking about writing and stuff. And I think it is great to talk the way we talk. We can really, you know, talk the bark off a tree, you know, but there are times when you're in certain situations, you do it. And like I find myself doing it nowadays when I'm on the phone with someone who may be in a call center in, you know, Bangalore or wherever. So I will pronounce the number 9 and 5 differently than I otherwise would. You know, I'd pronounce the I.
Demonstrate, please.
9, 5, versus 9-5. The great thing about Appalachia is we have the double second person plural. That's all y'all. You know, right. Usually when you say all y'all, you're telling off a whole group of people too.
There's also a class aspect to this, isn't there?
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. People who are living in Charleston who come from a more middle class background or upper middle class background do not speak the same way and will even make fun of the people who speak that way who are from a lower socioeconomic background.
It amazes me the way I hear people from the Charleston area, not to pick on them, and you know, possibly Huntington too, talk about those people in southern West Virginia like they're some kind of barbarian tribe, you know, and it just really amazes me how they do that. I always like that part of the state better, you know.
I think it's almost like the cousin you're embarrassed about or something. That's how they treat folks in southern West Virginia, rudely. Still to this day, if you want to portray stupidity, you just put on a redneck, stereotypical Appalachian and or southern accent, and that conveys stupid. Boston's interesting, too, because that's an area where it really does depend a lot on class and upbringing, whether you have that accent or not.
When people drop their R's, like, you know, I don't have the same animus there, but when but when people say, you know, going to the bar and driving a car, it's like, there's an R there, damn it.
Yeah.
What I really love to do is speak Spanish with a hillbilly accent around native speakers. I can drive them to tears, like, in minutes, you know, like, yo soy un hombre de los pobres. I am a friend of the poor.
There's
an amigo de los pobres, sorry. Spanish, they have cuss words that I was jealous of when I first understood them. It was like, my favorite one is like, yo cago en la leche de tu madre, which is kind of like, to say it gently, I crap in the milk of your mother. And when I first learned that expression, I was an adult. I was like, I could have used that in junior high, man. I could have got a lot of mileage with that.
I crap in the milk of your mother.
Yeah, they would use probably a stronger noun there, but... Yeah, that's one of the better ones.
Well, and I think that my experience has been people sometimes use that stereotype to their advantage because, you know, if everyone expects you to be stupid and then you play stupid, that can be a little secret weapon that you kind of hide back for when you need it.
In the black community, they call that signifying, you know.
And is this something that people turn up, turn down based on how they want to present themselves to the world? I asked you, Rick, have you ever considered, like, tuning down your accent, trying to sound more like Tom Brokaw to be able to portray yourself differently?
Hell no. But, yeah, no, that would never. I think it's a shame that when people feel like that. I'm all about cuss. Like, I taught my kids not to cuss in school, although they're really good at it when they're off set, especially my daughter. She could cuss the paint off a battleship, you know, but that's a code-switching thing, and... Mm-hmm.
But what about the other way? What if you were around people who had a very much stronger Appalachian? Would you turn it up a notch?
I think we probably do that unconsciously. Yeah. I think it's something we do.
If people make fun of politicians like Hillary Clinton for, you know, dropping their G's when they're in South Carolina. And, I think that's it's obvious. It's more recognizable when somebody like that does it. But it's something that everybody does, I think, to one degree or another.
You know, so who doesn't have an accent? Do I not have an accent?
I don't hear much of an accent in you,
much.
But that makes sense because you're from Iowa, which, you know, I guess the Midwestern accent.
And I don't think you do, but that's because we are the dominant. We just happen to be born in places that speak the dominant paradigm, the dominant dialect.
Someone from Massachusetts would probably think I sounded a little bit Southern.
Would you be concerned if your boys started to speak a little with a heavy Appalachian accent?
I did think about it the year after we got married. We lived in Alabama and considered staying there. And in Alabama, I would say it's much the deep South accent is much more pervasive across classes in the sense that, you know, even very educated, you know, upper class people in Alabama have it. And, you know, it did cross my mind, wow, they would definitely leave here speaking with a very Southern accent if we had had kids at the time. But, you know, it is what it is.
That was Lori Lynn on an episode of The Front Porch talking with Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee and host of the show, Scott Finn. While Rick gave us a few tips on how to speak Appalachian, our next segment shares other strategies around Appalachian dialects, how to deal with judgments based on your accent. Professor Amy Clark suggests getting to know the origins or history of your dialect. Amy is a sociolinguist and the co-chair of the University of Virginia Wise Appalachian Studies program. She's been there for about 15 years. She grew up in Southwest Virginia and says she's had people make fun of her for being Appalachian.
thinking I was going to laugh with them, thinking that I had internalized it and that I was going to laugh right along with their joke. And that is something that people encounter too. You know, it's so widespread. It's not taboo yet to make fun of someone who is perceived as white and lower class. That's not a taboo thing in America. So you do hear it more frequently, and you hear it, you know, you hear it on television. I mean, it's out there. It's on reality television.
An article in the University of Dayton Law Review says that discrimination against Appalachians can include a bias against things like the way we dress, the way we talk, and even the kinds of homes we live in. Trailer trash, barefoot and pregnant, you know? This type of discrimination is called Appalachism, and according to Michael H. Walker, the author of the article, these stereotypes simply further the idea that all Appalachian people are uneducated and unsophisticated and are, therefore, inferior to the rest of our country's citizens. But maybe the bias that's the hardest to shake, the thing that seems to follow us Appalachians wherever we go, is our accent or our dialect. Amy Clark writes about this issue in a book called Talking Appalachian. WMMT's Benny Becker recently sat down with Amy to talk about how Appalachian dialects came to be. In this interview, Amy also shares her personal journey of learning to embrace her voice.
Do you have an answer when someone asks you, what is the Appalachian dialect, or what does it mean to talk Appalachian?
Well, I start by saying, you know, we talk about it in the plural because there is no one Appalachian dialect. There are many. Really, we talk about Appalachian Englishes. Appalachia is a huge region. It's comprised of rural and urban places. And so when you think about the fact that migration patterns and industry and culture all influence a dialect, and you think about how many differences there are up and down the Appalachian mountain chain, then that helps people understand why there are so many different ways of saying things. And yet, I think what fascinates me is that we have features, like here in Central Appalachia, we have dialect features that we share with folks in Northern Appalachia, probably because of those migration patterns. I find that fascinating.
I mean, that's really interesting to me. I'll just say, I'm from Morgantown, West Virginia, so that is edging into Northern Appalachia,
yeah.
And I have some family from Pittsburgh, which I guess probably already is Northern Appalachia.
Yeah, it is.
And I've been a little surprised by how many... by some of the features. I thought they stopped when you went south, and some of them just pop up, like the car needs washed,
yes.
And that kind of thing.
Or washed.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that I lived just outside Pittsburgh for a while in a town called Indiana, Pennsylvania, and that's where I got my PhD. I think that's where I really started to pick up on this idea that I was still home, even though I was far, far away from where I'd grown up. I still felt like I was at home. There was something about the land and the people, and even the language, as different as it can be, that I still felt that connection to Appalachia. That was very clear to me the whole time that I was there.
That has me thinking. It sounds like to you it's the idea of being part of Appalachia still that makes it home.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that's been confusing me a little, because sometimes you have the conflict between people who feel strongly about Appalachia versus Appalachia.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have people who just don't really think of Appalachia as a thing at all. It's just, are you from around here or not?
Right.
Is there a place where everyone can kind of come together and agree what makes sense and where the identities should be drawn?
Well, identity is a complicated thing. And we spend a lot of time in the introduction of the book talking about identity as a complicated notion. Because, yes, I've talked with people who grew up here, but they do not identify as Appalachian, and I understand that. Same thing with dialect. I know people who have erased it purposefully because they don't want the association, and I understand that as well. I really think when it comes to identity, it's a choice you make. I grew up being sort of self-conscious of the way that I spoke, and then when you get multiple degrees in English, that just intensifies. You sort of feel pressure to... we call it leveling. You feel pressure to ease back on the way that you're pronouncing your words or really change your grammar patterns, sort of separate yourself from that. But then there came a point in my life when I started to understand that that could be part of me and I didn't have to apologize for it. it's deep. It has many complicated layers, I think. And I think it changes for us over time. I think it's something we have to grow into, maybe. And maybe there are people out there that have known from the beginning that they're Appalachian and that's what they are and they're not going to apologize for it. And that's great. But I think for so many of us, it's something we've had to work through and come to understand on a very personal level.
I had an experience where it was kind of that. Mm-hmm. Like, there were points where I started picking up more of an Appalachian dialect.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just kind of felt all this pressure around me that to not talk like that.
Really?
And I never really thought, like, oh, I shouldn't do this. It's just, mm-hmm. It wasn't a thing that was good. Well, I guess I'm wondering, when did it start to get that stigma? Was there a moment?
The dialect in particular. Well, it really started with local color literature that was written about the region back around the 19th century. Some people were traveling through and they wrote books about the people and they really exaggerated the speech and exaggerated some of what they saw to make it, you know, very romantic or silly, depending on what kind of book they wanted to sell. And then from books, you know, you had documentaries during the War on Poverty, and they found the worst pockets of Appalachia and the most pitiful-looking people to put on television. And from there, you've got films and Beverly Hillbillies TV shows. You've got Snuffy Smith comics. I mean, there are just so many ways that it has become this stock hillbilly character that speaks this stock hillbilly way. And I really think that that's what most people who aren't from around here, that's the perception they have. And, you know, stereotype works both ways. I mean, I know a lot of us around here think you go up north and everybody's rude and, you know, talks fast and nobody will help you out, those kinds of things. I mean, we have these notions based on place about all kinds of different people in different places.
So, well, do you think there is something that can be said about, like, I know people have studied what being isolated as a community does to the language. Is there a difference compared to other dialects of American English?
In terms of age, I would say, you know, we do have probably some of the oldest living dialects in the United States. Isolation, you know, could be part of it, but when you think about the industrialization of America and how many immigrants flooded this region, late 19th century, early 20th century, it's hard to say that we were isolated. You know, I mean, the minute they built those railroads and people were coming and going all the time, certainly there are these pockets of families that live in hollers. You know, I come from a family that, you know, five generations lived in the same place, and I do think that language is handed down, you know, from family to family. But I think for the longest time, if anything, it probably was preserved because people were farmers, you know, pre-industrialization. They weren't traveling much because they were working their farms. There were no formal schools set up for a long time. And so what started to standardize language was when they were going to school, when they were traveling, when they were working with the public, you know, then there's an awareness of how you're speaking. There's more of an awareness of what people think of how you're speaking or whether they can understand you. And so that, I think that was the process that took place that started to change. Now, why people choose to use some of these features that are very, very old has a lot to do with solidarity. They want that connection to place, and they want that connection to family. I know that's why I do it. You know, when I'm home, it's like wearing comfortable shoes and shoes that pinch your feet. You know, for some people, standard English just pinches their feet. You know, to switch into standard English all the time is an uncomfortable way to be. But to go home and be around friends and family, it's like a pair of comfortable shoes. You revert back to that home voice, and that's how you achieve solidarity with your family, is to sound like them and to speak with them in that way, so that I don't want to sound like Dr. Amy Clark with my family, right? And we call it code switching. I do workshops sometimes with universities on this very issue, is, you know, how do you shift from one to the other without abandoning your first voice?
Do you have like a short list of important things to keep in mind if you're a person who lives a life that includes code switching?
Well, you know, a dialect is made up of three things: your vocabulary, your grammar patterns, and the way that your sound, the way that your accent, the way that you say light or pains or pants. And I think being aware of whether or not you're clear, number one, you know, being clear. If I say, you know, there's a far drill and an air, how many people are going to understand that who are not from Central Africa? You know, there's a far drill and one air. Well, I'm saying there's a fire drill and 1 hour, right? But that's an accent issue that would cause misunderstanding and a safety problem, right? So even though sometimes it feels uncomfortable and some people may feel like they're trying to be someone they're not, I mean, code switching is an important skill to know for certain professions so that you can. For teachers, we talk to teachers about it, just modeling for your students, but not erasing, you know. I think grammar, of all those features, grammar is probably the one that causes people the most trouble because it's rarely ever acceptable for grammar to be non-standard, you know, in written and spoken English, like double negatives, ain't got none, or irregular verbs being leveled, like I note it. And yet, that's such a part of the oral tradition around here. It's such a part of storytelling that it can creep into your spoken language easily. So it's just an awareness of audience and thinking and making sure that you're clear.
Can I ask, do you have thoughts on why that might be, that people can be a little more forgiving about your accent or even your word choice than they will be about your grammar decisions? And there's a sense that if you're not using standard grammar, then you're just wrong. Do you have a sense for why that could be?
Well, because that's what they teach in public, that's what we teach in schools, right? That's, standard English is the power dialect of English. You know, of all the dialects of English, there are some associated with the working class and some associated with the upper class, and standard English is the power dialect, and that's what we teach in American public schools. And so you're told from kindergarten all the way up that there's a right way and a wrong way, and the focus is almost always on grammar. And so I think that's it. I think that's why we put so much emphasis on it. But there are also a lot of people who say that we use grammar patterns to judge. It's a way to be classist and racist without saying that you are, to judge the way that people use grammar. And so I don't think everyone who calls themselves a grammar snob does that, but certainly I think there are people who use it as a way to diminish people of certain class or a certain race.
That was Appalachian linguist Amy Clark speaking with WMMT reporter Benny Becker. So what do you think about what Amy just said? You know, on Inside Appalachia, we often try to give voice to the voiceless. So I think it's interesting that as soon as we Appalachians open our mouth to speak, we're almost instantly judged. So where do you think these judgments come from? Do you think making fun of someone's strong dialect is a way for people in power to weaken the working class? Tell us what you think by sending us a tweet. We are at In Appalachia. I'm at Jessica Y. Lilly. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll pick back up with this conversation about Appalachian dialects.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Before the break, we were hearing from Amy Clark talking about her new book called Talking Appalachian. Amy mentioned a grammar snob, and if you've used social media, you've probably run across one or two online. In Amy's book, she also shares a beautiful poem about grappling with technology when technology won't let you keep your original voice. Here's Amy Clark reading that poem.
Spell Check by Ann Shelby. It's handy, but not much account for writing hillbilly poems with. It won't let you waller, won't let you foller a feller at the holler. Makes you have titles where titties ought to be. I'll go along with changing logwoods into dogwoods, but before I could say undo, it turned my house cat into a house coat. Salad, new ground, June bug, graveyard, not in dictionary. You can't have a grandbaby on this thing without special arrangements. One spell transformed my taters into tatters, served me subpoenas when I ordered soup beans. Now it wants to replace the home place with just some place. Is this the same spell that changed proud to poor, turned minnows into memories? I need flies buzzing in this poem, cool snap of beans breaking on the porch, the tenor of coonhounds on a moonlit ridge. Exit. Float a while on a honeysuckle breeze. Spell. How long to sit on a sycamore bank with your feet in the creek.
Today, we're talking about Appalachian dialects and about how some people are discriminated against because of the way many Appalachians talk. There's even a term for it, Appalachianism. Like we mentioned earlier in the show, an article in the University of Dayton Law Review defines Appalachianism as discrimination based on the traditions and lifestyles of Appalachians. Huh. So basically who we are, our basic existence. It's a form of discrimination that stretches across race lines, and the judgment of one's language can reveal both classism, racism, or both. Let's rejoin WMMT's Benny Becker and his conversation with Amy Clark, co-editor of a book called Talking Appalachian.
Is there something that you wish was happening more often in schools, in education, and how the dialect gets treated in this region?
Well, I think it is happening more often now. I think there are programs that are teaching code switching as opposed to a right and a wrong way of speaking English. I know that the program we use started in Tidewater, Virginia, with African American elementary school students who were having trouble with benchmark scores on their tests, and they did this method of comparing your home dialect to standard English and not saying one is right or one is wrong, but saying here are the differences and here's what you do if you want to shift into one and shift out of the other one. So I would love for all schools to be doing that, you know, instead of saying you have to erase or abandon this voice and adopt this voice, because like I said, I always come back to the literature. You know, where would we be? We wouldn't have this wonderful body of African-American literature or Appalachian literature without the distinctions of voice. I think that's what makes some of it so rich.
So it sounds like you think the Appalachian dialect and the African-American dialect, and I guess also they intersect, but do mm-hmm. you feel like those two are kind of in a class together of regional dialects that are facing similar issues in language
sure.
in America?
Yeah, and there are a lot of similarities that we share. And Walt Wolfram, who wrote one of the chapters in my book, he has studied both dialects extensively, and he's written extensively about both. In fact, the chapter in my book is about African-American vernacular in Central Appalachia. So, yeah, lots of similarities and issues.
Is there one issue that to you kind of strikes you as the biggest issue facing people who speak these dialects?
Probably, well, I don't know that I could say this is the biggest, but it's a big one, is this assumption that people speak that way because they're not as smart, they're not as intelligent as other people, and that's simply not true. William LeBov, one of the most famous linguists, right, disproved that in the 1960s with inner city kids. Because people were saying the same thing about African-American vernacular, and he did studies that disproved that. There's no difference in cognitive function. It really is a cultural, regional thing that we do. It comes down to solidarity with your community, with your peers, and with your family.
So do you think that, is there something with pride on the part of the speakers? Is there something else that you think could help make it so that people who speak these dialects, people who speak these kinds of English, face less judgment when they leave their communities?
Sure. I think understanding where it comes from is one of the biggest things. That's why Nancy and I did this book. You know, understanding the history of the dialects, the histories of the migration patterns, the influences and where these phrases come from, the fact that the grammar patterns, a lot of people don't know that these grammar patterns came from the Scots-Irish and the Southern Englanders who first came here, and that some of them are very, very old, that they predate Chaucer even. So it's not the result of an inability to speak standard English. So I think that knowledge, that understanding of the history of the dialects, and then why people continue to use them, even when they know that standard English exists and they know how to use it, those are two big things. Knowledge is key. I think knowledge in many ways can combat that stigma and the stereotype, because the stereotype is based on a myth that people don't know standard English, or that they aren't as smart as other people, or maybe that they're lazy. You know, they're associated with the working class, but it's not just working class people who speak in vernacular dialects. People from all classes speak in vernacular dialects.
Coming off of that, could you say a little more about what the different influences are that have shaped this dialect? Could you kind of just give like a quick time lapse of how these, you know, how these influences came in and layered on top of each other?
Well, the Southern Englanders were the first to bring the dialects here, and then the Scots-Irish came through probably in the biggest numbers. I think by the mid to late 18th century, there were 200,000 Scots-Irish here, and then in 100 years' time, I think there was something like 2 million. But when they came through the northern cultural hearth and they came across to the mountains, the German settlers had already taken up most of that land, and there's some German influence as well. And so they turned south and they fanned out through the Appalachian mountain chain, and the theory is that they understood that these mountains were like home, and they knew how to live there and they knew how to work there. So they went all the way down into Georgia. They fanned out along the mountain chain. So those groups had the most to do with early dialects. Then when industrialization happened and huge waves of immigrants, you know, you can look at any cemetery in some of these coal camp towns and you know how diverse they were. That's going to have an effect. When people left to find work in the factories, that's going to have an effect. Dialect is going to go with people, and influence is going to come back with people as they're traveling back and forth. And again, as transportation became more common, people were coming in and out more frequently, that's going to cause some changes to the dialects. So I think all of that together had a lot to do with it. But again, you're going to have these pockets of places where families are going to stay generation after generation after generation, and certainly that helped to preserve some of the forms, some of the grammar patterns in particular, some of the vocabulary and the way that people were speaking.
So you were kind of describing the whole thing in broad strokes, which, thank you, I know it's mm-hmm. a hard thing to do. but then these pockets that you're talking about, mm-hmm. each of those ends up being a little bit different from the next one, right? Just like each person talks sure. a little different from the next. Mm-hmm. Are there any of these pockets that, you know, little pockets of Appalachian English that you've found particularly interesting or surprising, and that they're a mixture of, like, how did that feature get over there yeah. from this place?
I haven't studied any particular communities specifically. I know there are some studies in my book of particular communities about what is going away and what is intensifying.
That's Professor Amy Clark talking with Benny Becker about language. Some of the phrases that are going away include words that came over from settlers hundreds of years ago. Okay, Amy Clark says one of the best ways to deal with being judged because of the way you talk is to know the history of your dialect. So we wanted to share some phrases that came over from Scotland and Ireland, and they might sound familiar to you. And Roxy Todd's going to help me out with this. Hey, Roxy.
Hi, Jessica.
So these are from an article written by Michael Montgomery from the University of South Carolina. He cataloged hundreds of phrases that came over from Scotland and Ireland. Okay, let's see. Some of these include done finished, as in I done finished my lessons.
Or don't care to, as in I don't care to help you.
Fixin', as in I'm a fixin' to give you a fat lip.
Then there's bad tempered, as in she was feeling a bit bad tempered.
Or some that I recognize, like pooch, which means protrude.
And then there's Boilt.
Boilt? I think it's Bolt.
Boilt, right?
Bolt.
Bolt. What does that mean again?
Oh, you know, the past tense of boil. Bull, boy, boil. See, I struggle with that tone, too. Is it boil or bull? How do you say it?
I say boil. Okay. I say boil. Yeah.
I think I say both.
Okay, Bolt. That's
code
a new
switching
one.
It, yeah. And then there's you all, which is the second person plural pronoun.
And then there's also the phrase let on, as in she let on that she didn't really like ramps.
So that's just a few of the many words and phrases we Appalachians use that came over from Scotland and Ireland. Cue Celtic music. We put a few of those phrases on our website at wvpublic.org. You can go check them out and see if you recognize any more. Amy Clark recognized even more of these Scotch-Irish rooted phrases from her great-grandmother.
My great-grandmother, I grew up down in Lee County, Virginia, in Jonesville, and she would talk about peafowls. She had peafowls that lived in the backyard. She would sew a counterpin for the bed instead of a bedspread. She kept her clothes in a chiffon robe. You know, and these are words I don't use, but she did. And so I've always remembered the words that, you know, haints. She'd tell haint tales from the holler. So those were always things that fascinated me, you know, those words that were that she continued to use that we don't use anymore.
Do you think that there's really been a shift in how this has gotten passed down? It sounds like there was kind of for a lot of people, there was a streak of, you know, 4, 5, 6 generations where things didn't get changed much. Do you think that there's a big shift now? And if so, what do you think is causing it?
I think there's probably a big shift. I think as education has become more attainable, I did a study with 4-generation families of women. I'd looked at 7 groups. And you can see that as women become more educated in their families, education doesn't make you smarter, but it means that you have to work with more people and that you're going to get a job that's going to cause you to work with more people. And so what I found was that language was changing as a result of their need to work and the level of educational attainment and having to code shift more frequently for their occupations. You know, these were teachers and librarians and principals. And so words like that just don't have a place. You know, words like peafowl and chiffon robe, and they just don't have a place. And so, you know, if you go from a generation who lives on a farm to a generation that works exclusively in an office, then naturally that's going to change the type of vocabulary that you use. So I really think that has a lot to do with it.
So what comes of that? Are there good things to people's language kind of coming more towards the middle, or are there bad things that come with losing these words, or do we know?
I think language, I don't know. Language, like I said, it's not static. It's a moving target. You can't say anything definitive about it. It's always going to change as people change. It will come and it will go. You know, people said when the radio was invented that would diminish the way that people speak. They said the same thing about television. They're saying the same thing now about the internet and the fact that we can talk face-to-face with someone from all the way around the world. Language will always change. Do I think Appalachian Englishes will die out? I doubt it. I think that we have a very strong culture that we celebrate in so many ways. It's not just in everyday conversation. It's in the music. It's in the literature. You know, it's in religion. It's infused into so many different aspects of the region and its culture that I don't see it dying out anytime soon.
So do you have a vision of what its future would be like for the dialect?
Oh, you know, probably different variations, but with some of the same relics floating around. You know, there are features that we probably won't hear anymore. There's a feature that Kirkhazen says is dying out in West Virginia, and I suspect in other places too. It's called the A prefix. When you say I'm a going somewhere, I'm a fixin' to do something, he says that's leveling in West Virginia. So it's probably leveling everywhere else with older generations, especially. So I think I just envision changes, some terms becoming relics, new terms, new phrasing popping up, becoming part of the everyday vernacular. That's inevitable, you know.
You used the word leveling. Could you just say what that means?
We talk about a dialect feature that is fading or dying out, we call it leveling.
And the idea there is it's like it used to stick out as something different. Now
it was a prominent part of the spoken vernacular, but people aren't using it as much anymore, so you just don't hear it anymore. And usually leveling comes, you know, with each generation. So the older generations may be using it, but the younger generations aren't.
The other thing you mentioned that got me curious is you were talking about new features coming in. Are there like new things happening that are uniquely Appalachian that are happening in language that you know of?
I don't think there's anything uniquely Appalachian. I could be wrong, but I you know, like I said, communication is a global thing now. Appalachia is not this isolated community, and so people come and people go. So to say anything's uniquely Appalachian would probably be, I don't know how it could be.
Coming back to the experience, I guess, of individual people from here, especially I'm thinking about people who have, I guess, what an outsider would consider a thick accent, but I guess what would be the right way to talk about that? To say someone has like a
thick accent's fine. That's how we describe it sometimes, okay. A heavy accent.
Okay, but it's really just saying their dialect is more Appalachian. Is that what it means? Or?
It's a strong vernacular variety. Yeah, the farther away you get from standard English, you know, the stronger the vernacular. Yeah, okay. The heavier the accent.
So we're vernacular. That just means vernacular is just kind of non-standard every day. Mm-hmm. Okay, so for someone who's most comfortable speaking more like that. Mm-hmm. Do you have advice that you give people who find themselves in a situation where, you know, people are judging them, are giving them a hard time, or sometimes are even having a hard time understanding them? Is there, mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite approach for those kinds of situations?
I don't get that question very often, but I think there are two things there. If someone is saying, I can't understand you, well, code switching is important, you know, repeating yourself or using a different term or using a different pronunciation and knowing how to do that. But if someone's judging you, then I think the best way to counter that is with information. You know, if someone judges me, then my response is to tell them about, well, let me tell you about my dialect. I'll tell you about the history of my dialect. You know, I don't have anything witty to say right at the moment, but I think information is the key. So I think knowledge is probably the best way to counter stereotypical assumptions. It's just know about your linguistic history. Educate yourself about why you sound the way that you do, and then let people know if they have a problem with it.
And so the important points are kind of what you were saying before. Mm-hmm. This comes from these particular places, which is where my family's been from, and this is what they picked up, and this is how I speak.
And this is how I speak, and this is what's comfortable for me. Yeah.
Well, what about code switching in the other direction? Do you have thoughts on people who come in from outside Appalachia, or people, even a person like myself who, you know, I didn't grow up with a very strong vernacular accent. Mm-hmm. I just have little hints, I think, here and there. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you have thoughts on a person coming from outside and wanting to code switch more towards the vernacular?
I think if you're here long enough, you pick up certain ways of saying things without really. It's a subconscious thing. My husband's from Richmond, Virginia, and I've noticed, and he does too. He knows it. In his accent, sometimes he'll say, I think, instead of I think. So I think it's mostly a subconscious thing. I have friends who have moved to England, and they sound English now, you know? So, and I don't think they meant to do that. I think it just happens. I think you tend to mirror, and I've read studies about this, you tend to mirror the speech that's around you when you're around it long enough. But sure, I mean, if somebody wants to come in and start talking Appalachian, then more power to them. It's very hard, though. I've been in a lot of writing workshops with writers who don't know the dialect well enough to write in it, but they want to learn, and that's hard. I think that's harder when you're not a native, to know those nuances of sound without creating caricature.
We'll pick it back up with Benny Becker from WMMT and Amy Clark in a few minutes after the break. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Lafayette Flats, vacation rentals with original art by local artists in historic Fayetteville, West Virginia. New River Gorge adventures begin at lafayetteflats.com. Looking for a rewind button? Don't worry. Inside Appalachia is available as a podcast on iTunes, Downcast, and wvpublic.org. You can subscribe and listen on your own time. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we're talking about language and the way we talk. Next, we're going to talk with Kirk Hazen, a professor in the Department of English at West Virginia University. Hazen also directs the West Virginia Dialect Project. It works to promote more understanding about dialect diversity.
The effort of the West Virginia Dialect Project is to teach people about how language works and help them understand that everyone has a dialect, that there are many different standards, and whether or not your particular dialect is seen as good or bad is a social determination and not a linguistic determination.
And here's the thing, the more we know about all these different regional dialects and explore the cultural richness that lies beneath the surface of our own language, Hazen thinks that type of understanding will help empower Appalachians.
That kind of knowledge about how language works is something we're trying to get out to everyone. And that will certainly help carry forward more equitable situations and help promote social justice for all dialect speakers, not just ones that have the most privileged dialect of the area.
For the Dialect Project, Hazen and his students go out and record voices of people. Then they catalog their way of speaking. He also compares these contemporary language patterns with recordings of older Appalachians. And he's discovered that some of the dialects here are changing as the new generation interacts more and more with social media and the internet.
Some of the changes we're finding is that a few older patterns that were stigmatized, they were seen as bad, are generally on the decline. One of those is using was with plural subjects, such as we was out late. This is something that in the early 70s in West Virginia was fairly common in certain areas, but it's dropped off dramatically since that time.
But Hazen says there are some new features in the Appalachian dialect that are starting to become more common.
What's risen is somewhat of a camouflaged feature related to it, where was is actually contracted so that you get something like we's out late. This is a feature that's actually we find in higher rates among younger people. So there's some give and take in terms of the fluctuations.
That was Kirk Hazen, director of the West Virginia Dialect Project. In the next few years, he's hoping to work more with public school teachers to incorporate dialect education and understanding about Appalachian dialects in their classrooms. I think it's really fascinating that language can be so complex and politically charged. But why? I think Amy Clark summed it up nicely.
Because not only do you have all of this information and all of these pieces that make the dialects what they are, it's a very political hot button topic. You'll hear on the radio and you'll hear it with politicians, and it gets connected to immigration. If people want to come to this country, they need to learn English and speak English. And I hear people complaining all the time about that. So language is a political topic, and that's another reason why it's not easy. Everybody has an opinion, and sometimes it's really connected to emotion.
Connected to emotion. Mm-hmm. I guess connected to emotion, that kind of to me is, I guess mm-hmm. so much of it isn't conscious.
Yeah, people have emotional reactions sometimes to these issues rather than thinking them through, you know, and thinking about them in the way that we've been talking about it. And again, some of that is the human tendency or people's choices about how they perceive class, how they perceive race. If you see somebody have an emotional reaction to a variety of a language, it's probably the person they're judging. It's not the language itself. That's a hard fact, but that's a fact.
But even though it can be so difficult,
Amy says we should all keep trying to understand and respect each of our unique dialects, including our own.
I say own it. I say that's your voice place. That's who you are. Don't be ashamed of it. I'm not. It doesn't mean I'm not self-aware. I am. I realize when I'm in a room full of people and none of them are from Appalachia that I sound different. And sometimes that can make people very uncomfortable and they don't want to be different. And I understand that. I deal with this with students in communication studies. There are students who say, I want to go into broadcasting. I can't sound like this anymore. You know, what am I going to do? And we have that conversation. There are some careers that are just, there's the expectation that you're going to have to sound like you're from nowhere, right? You're going to have to sound standardized. And I understand that too.
When I was younger, I too was told in school that I should try to lose my thick accent if I wanted to have a successful career in broadcasting. And believe me, I tried. Listening to NPR and other national news on TV, you typically hear a general American dialect in most people's voices, and most of what you hear on NPR is standard English. It's good to know grammatical rules and know how to speak in standard English, but I also think that we exclude a lot of people if we don't make room in the media for unique voices and dialects, too. But as Amy Clark pointed out, language and accents are a hot-button political issue. And maybe you disagree with me here and think maybe all broadcasters should strive to sound the same. What do you think? We want to hear from you. Send us a tweet at InAppalachia. I'm at Jessica Y. Lilly. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, and the Front Porch Podcast. Music in today's show was provided by Andy Agnew Jr., Ben Townsend, the Hillbilly Gypsies, and Dinosaur Burbs. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Jesse Wright. Our audio mixer is Xander Alloy. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.